words to re-fulfill, and ye harm none to what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Well, merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Parax Radio Network. My guest tonight, Richard Sennett, is an internationally known and respected researcher of the paranormal. He's a prolific author and teacher, has been hunting ghosts since 1978, and has appeared on more TV shows on the subject than you can shake a wand at. But what some people might not know about him is that he's also a fiction author and has a new book out, a supernatural thriller called Fade to Fear, about the glamour of the old silent film era in Hollywood, the beckoning of a 1920s haunted mansion, and a romance writer who is house-sitting and encounters a malevolent ghost. Now the question is, will she survive or become one of the ghosts of the old Van Horst mansion? Well, we're not going to ask him to give away the ending, but he's here to talk about the book. So please join me in welcoming Richard Sennett. Hi, Richard.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, I'm happy that you are. And first off, I'd like to say that I bought the book and I read it straight through in one sitting and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Well done.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. I hope I added a few twists and turns to the plot to keep it interesting.
You did. I guess as a writer too, you know, we always look for that in other people's work because it's like watching a TV show and you know what's going to happen. You know it from the beginning. I mean, they map it out so easily. So I absolutely adore little twists and turns that kind of make you go, okay, that was cool. You know, and yes, there were a couple of them in there and I'm like, oh, very nice. Very nice. But you know what? Most people probably think of you as a nonfiction writer because you've written so many ghost books and stuff. But this isn't your first fiction book, is it?
No. In fact, my first book I ever wrote was fiction. I did that when I was 14. And it was a science fiction story. And the very fact that I finished it is pretty amazing. It was some 400 pages. And it's never been published, and I don't think I ever would publish it because it's bloody awful. But I still enjoy writing. You have to be a little bit crazy to enjoy putting things on paper. And I've always had a fondness for it. And this book was a product of many years of work. And I had written several other fiction pieces, but they were not ghost stories. They were, in fact, action adventure, in a style called steampunk, which is science fiction like Jules Verne. It's 19th century science fiction. Mm-hmm. And I wrote those. I had a great deal of fun penning them. And I wrote, I attempted to write a romance novel, which just didn't work. I have great respect now for romance writers after attempting to do it myself. And then I took this up.
Well, this was a very good choice. And, you know, they tell us as authors that to get the best book possible that we can write, we must write about what we know. And you, more than most, know about ghosts, but you also have a great deal of knowledge about old Hollywood. In fact, it's a family legacy, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, my grandfather came out to Hollywood back in 1924 and started working in the movie business, building sets, doing grip work, stuff like that. And he worked for Metro and then later MGM. And my dad worked there. And my uncles, all four of them, worked there. My aunt worked at Columbia Studios. So it's been kind of in the blood, if you will. And some of the very first ghost stories I actually recorded, I gathered around the Thanksgiving table, where people just talking about, oh, that soundstage or that building was haunted, and what they had experienced and what they had heard about. So I got a lot of background, especially on the early years of Hollywood. And that went a long way with this particular project. And I also included a number of events that I had actually investigated in haunted mansions down in Hollywood area. So a lot of the things in there are based on reality, not out of my imagination.
Yeah, and I know, you know, I had read that before, and it kind of scared me because if some of the things were similar to your personal experiences that were in the book, you kind of deserve a purple heart because it's pretty phenomenally scary. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because I've investigated some old Hollywood homes, Mary Astor's, and I think you did that one too. And Gary Cooper, the late great Gary Cooper, to name a couple. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you feel the same way, but when you walk into these homes, you feel like you've entered a time warp and you're back in their time, not ours. And it doesn't matter how it's decorated on the inside, you know, with new tenants and whatever. Have you noticed this as well? And if so, how do you account for it? I mean, is it like residual energy left by those who live there, the fact that they still might be there, or could it just be the essence of the house?
I think it might be all three. I know I investigated the Goldwyn Mansion, you know, Samuel Goldwyn, the G and MGM. He has a gigantic mansion. In fact, I kind of used it as a pattern for the one in the book. It looks like, you know, Norma Desmond's house in Sunset Boulevard, a big Spanish pile that looks more like a hotel than a home. And it was, I will say this, the people who bought it, a couple of guys bought it, they restored it back to the 1930s. So when you walked through that door, you felt like you were back in 32 or 34, and they were having ghost problems there. And my wife and I did a full investigation of that place, and that was spooky. And that's where I first got to meet Eric von Stroheim, the silent director and actor who haunts that building.
Ah, that's so, the one. Okay.
And then there are so many other places that I had. Like, if you recall the book, I mentioned the record player that would keep playing even though it's unplugged. I actually had that happen. I went to a place, I had the dang thing playing on me. I unplugged it, and I'd still hear the music playing. It was really freaky. So a lot of those things are based on reality.
Yeah, like I said, Purple Heart time. Well, I know when I went to Gary Cooper's house, the people that had bought that also had put it back to his time. So the interior was, but although it was like 50s, I mean, that's when he owned that particular house. That's the house he passed away in. But you did feel the essence of it there because they had it decorated like that. Now, the Mary Astor house, you know, there were it was rented out all the time. And the people that were living there, it was a group of kids pretty much. It was not decorated classically. I mean, it was just a kid's house, kind of. But still,
yeah, it looked like kind of like a college dorm. And it had fallen on hard times. It was decaying, which kind of gave it a spooky feeling all its own. But we went through there, and just before they moved out, they were so freaked out, they couldn't stand it anymore. We went through there, my wife and I, and a team. We got all kinds of reactions. We didn't get Mary Astor, but the events that they described were similar to events that Mary Astor had described in her biography. So I think that she may well have haunted the place.
Yeah, I was really kind of freaked out. We were upstairs in one of the bedrooms, and they had these big French windows, And it was not a very big room. It was, you know, kind of smallish. And as I was sitting on the bed trying to get EVP and stuff, I looked up at the window, and for some strange reason, I didn't want to stand up because I was drawn to that window, like almost like I wanted to jump out of it. And that doesn't happen very often. And I asked them if anybody had jumped from the window that they knew of, and I don't think they knew too much of the history of the house. But it was really kind of overpowering. Strange.
I know the room of which you speak, and that window was a double French door on it, and it opened and closed by itself on several occasions, at least the witnesses told me.
Yeah, they mentioned that too.
And they would hear sounds, typical haunted house stuff, you know. I went to Steve McQueen's house over in Santa Paula that he had rented and lived there until he finally died of cancer. But his ghost appears to be there. I don't know if it's still there. I haven't been over there lately. But I know that when Steve moved in, it was haunted by somebody else. In fact, Steve McQueen's, one of the people who worked there at the house, told me that he told him that Steve had, in fact, seen a ghost woman in the house. And he ran all through it trying to find her, and there's nobody there. So I found that people who are dynamic, like actors, directors, artists, they tend to leave stuff behind more than like your average person.
It's true, but here's a question for you. I'm talking about, you know, it already being haunted and then he haunts it, and people have discussed this for ages. Do you think that spirits, like, do you think that Steve McQueen's spirit now can see the spirit of the lady that haunted that house prior? Or are sometimes they on different levels from different eras and they don't even know each other exists?
That's a great question. I have asked people, I've asked psychics, I've tried people to try to communicate with the ghost. It appears that they seem to be on a different wavelength, so they're not like teaming up or making a ghostly gaggle, if you want. They are, in fact, separate, and they don't seem to know the other people are there unless they are somehow linked to that person, like a brother or sister. But people from different eras and epochs don't seem to get along or be visible to one another.
Yeah, and they probably also see the house in the different incarnations. You know, the person that's haunting it that might have been there, you know, 100 years ago, to the one that's haunting it from 50 years ago, to the one that's haunting it now. Of course, the house has gone through renovations and stuff, and they all may very well see it as they remember it or as they were there, I think.
Oh, very much. I've had places where they've had, like, a hardwood floor. Then they took the hardwood floor out and put something else in, carpet or something. Yet people will hear, like, hard shoes walking on a hardwood floor, even though the hardwood floor has been removed. So it's pretty freaky. It seems that they somehow are walking around in sort of a ghost house of what it was long ago.
I think it's fascinating. But, you know, I think when we write about Hollywood, even when it's just about a particular haunted location, we get embroiled in the backstories of the places we visit and are compelled to dig further and further. For example, when I began writing my Ghosts of Hollywood series, my intention was primarily to pick out locations, investigate them, and write about my findings. But from the very introduction of the series, I went back in time to like 1853, you know, when all that stood in Hollywood was a single adobe hut. And that theme seemed to continue throughout my book. So in addition to the books just being about specific locations and hauntings, they're also historical in nature with lots of backstories, glamour in some cases, and a lot of little known facts. Now, you grew up in Hollywood, as I did, and while some people might think we should probably be kind of ho-hum about our hometown, it's as fascinating to us as it is to the rest of the world. Why do you think that is? It's kind of weird.
I think you're absolutely correct. And the best thing any ghost hunter, anyone who's interested in this study should do is learn the history of the location. That's one of the defects they have on the TV shows, is they're going all over the country to make a wide-ranging kind of set of tales, but they're never there long enough to really get the background of the site, the house, what happened there, and all that. Oh, they get the story by interviewing a few people, but to really understand it, you can't just breeze in 2 days and then breeze out. You've got to spend some time. Now, fortunately, I have the connections and background in Hollywood and Culver City, because my family's from Culver City, so I could get some good ideas about what was there. And now I am a historian. That was the trade I took up while I went to college. And by the way, that has really served me very well in my ghost hunting and in my writing career.
Oh, yeah. I imagine it would be. Because there's such a curiosity factor, and things that people would take for granted or just assume, you know, it's not necessarily correct. And I mean, for example, you talk about the strip on Hollywood Boulevard where the Hollywood Wax Museum is, okay? You know, that whole strip of buildings. You know, at one point, the upstairs above the Wax Museum was a very popular nightclub. Well, then it turned into a luggage shop or something. But one of the things that I noticed, and a lot of people buy into this, was that there was a sign in front of the Wax Museum one day, and it said, this is the location of a particular school, I forget the name, and it burned to the ground and lots of people died. Well, if you go and dig back a little further, there was no such school there, you know, but it made a good story for them, somebody to put that misinformation out there.
Well, that happens too often, and I hate it. Because there's enough real history and real tragedies, you don't have to invent stuff. You can have, you don't need to go out and say that over and over again. I've found, you know, psychics, ghost hunters, just kind of coming up with things out of whole cloth. And a good case in point is I have done a full study of the Glen Tavern Inn. I started investigating there in 82. And I got the whole history of the place. We did a continuous study for 2 years. We actually found that it was linked to a lot of movie stars, by the way. They made a movie there, or made lots of movies there, and they still do, as a matter of fact. They still make a little low-budget sci-fi type pictures there. And recently, they had a TV show come in, and the psychic I had never heard of came and talked about the ghost of a headless prostitute. And I went, wait. I went through all my notes. There was well, there was a prostitute, but she had her head firmly attached to her body. And I'm getting, where does he get this from? I mean, and pretty much I think he just manufactured it or got it psychically. I have no idea. But I will say this, and I could be wrong about his, him, is that many haunted places, the ghosts change. One would think that like, Mary Astor would haunt her mansion or something. But they change, you know. And I've been to places where they have a persistent ghost, and then all of a sudden, after a few years, that particular phantom is no longer seen, and a new ghost is encountered.
I think.
Have you had that happen?
Yeah, I have, and I think I've figured it out, sort of, in a way. My convoluted logic is that those places that are haunted will attract other spirits, because there's some kind of, I'm making a funny here, but like a neon sign right above it with an arrow pointing down that, you know, this is a place where you might feel comfortable. This is, you know, okay to go to. I think the residual energy, or just the energy possibly of, you know, the ghost that is there, will attract others. Just like we that do the work, they're attracted to us when we're doing it.
Also, there's a theory in England. I have a lot of friendships with English ghost hunters, and we talk on email a lot. They're doing a lot of cutting edge over there, cutting edge work. And one of their theories is that there are things called ley lines. These are this invisible grid, and where the ley lines, which are kind of like a net, where they meet, that's where ghosts like to gather. And I have done some studies, you know, with dowsing rods and all, and I have found that there are these ley lines and these meeting spots in many of the haunted houses that I've investigated over the years. Mm-hmm. And so I like to call it like Spook Central. It's believed that these ley lines are avenues where ghosts can move. And mm-hmm. no wonder, obviously, if you've got one of these nodes or centers in your house, you're going to get lots of different things coming and going. Well, at least that's a theory.
Well, yeah, and I've also heard the theory about EMF, where houses that are very close to big power towers, with where a lot of EMF is shooting out of them all the time, that also seems to be an attraction.
Oh, I agree 100%. In fact, guess what? I don't know if you've found this, but I have found almost every radio station is haunted. Mm-hmm. Almost every one. Especially the older ones, not newer ones, not so much, but I think the high energy levels of all the electrical equipment is somehow either traps or attracts or these spirits there. Or mm-hmm. there's another alternative, and that is DJs or radio people are dynamic, egotistical people, and they're just the kind of people who would come back from beyond death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they come back to their old job and hang out. Well, you know, some people can't get enough of the other side. They come back here, like, you know, the story about Hollywood Forever, where the people from Paramount, which, for people that don't know, Paramount Studios back, I mean, they share a common wall at one point at the cemetery, mm-hmm. and a lot of people from Paramount are buried at Hollywood Forever, and they say that they see spirits going to work every morning, too, you know? So, and of course, and there's the Groucho Marx story where he had his office over on Sunset at the Laugh Factory, mm-hmm. and people have seen him going to work in his office every morning, too. Okay, Richard, so you were talking about Eric von Stroheim earlier on, and, you know, we were talking about character actors a minute ago, but von Stroheim himself was a character that was larger than life in real life. And
very much.
And a scary one, too. And one of the main characters in your book, Von Horst, was based on the famed director, von Stroheim. And for those who might not be familiar with him, can you give us a little background information on von Stroheim?
He was a German actor, as the name implies. He's a military man, cut his hair very short. He served in the cavalry, actually. And he was a great director. In fact, he was very innovative for his time, made a bunch of very compelling movies using very adult subjects, such as women's infidelity, things of that nature, child abuse, all kinds of things which were not kosher for the silent era. But what did it for him was this one movie he made, and that was, he bought this novel called Greed, and he loved it. And so he made a movie of it. But unfortunately, he made the movie exactly like the novel. So it turned out being over 14 hours long. And Samuel Goldwyn, who was making the movie and objected to it, had this big argument with him. Von Stroheim wanted to have it released as part one, part two, part three. And he said, no, audiences won't do it. They won't go to it. So he gave the film to someone else who butchered it and chopped it into 2 hours out of 14. And they had this huge argument. And Goldwyn said, you'll never work in this town again. And so he left, and he couldn't find any directing job. So he went to France, and he started acting. And he was in a bunch of very famous films in France. And because of their popularity, he was brought back to the United States, this time as an actor. And he was many times used as bad guys in World War II films. In fact, in Five Graves to Cairo, he played General Erwin Rommel. So he's a very versatile actor. And again, remarkably, he was in Sunset Boulevard, where he played the chauffeur. And in the movie, the chauffeur, Max, had also been a silent movie director. So he kind of actually mirrored his own life, his own kind of falling on hard times and rebuilding of his career, which, of course, the same thing that happened to Orson Welles and many of the early Hollywood directors who were seen as being too difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm. And anybody who has seen Sunset Boulevard, and I think that's where most people would know him, mm-hmm. that character was exceedingly scary. And Von Horst, in your book, is a dreadful, dreadful man. I mean, you know, they always say that the best writers, you can tell who's a good writer when they make a character that the readers hate. And Von Horst, as I was reading it, I wanted to smack him really hard. He's an ugly, ugly man, and you wrote him so well. And you do talk about the movie that he does in there, and Van Horst's movie that he plays. And I think the scary part, well, it is scary, is that he not only is a malevolent spirit, he kind of can manifest himself into, and I don't want to give anything away necessarily, but he can physically attack as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to add that element. Now, Von Horst is based on von Stroheim, and mm-hmm. there were some similarities. They called von Stroheim the Mad Hung of Hollywood. And his films had much that was, well, depraved, a little bit saucy to them. But, of course, Erich von Stroheim was not a Satanist, and he did not do that sort of element. That was all, of course, fiction added in, based on other literary characters, of course. But he was the core of the character for von Horst.
Yeah. And really, really well done with him. And also another character in your book, Helen, was based on Mary Miles Minter. And to those of us who know Hollywood history, she played a pivotal role, they say, in the death of director William Desmond Taylor. Now,
right.
I have to say, I think I did have a bit of a ghostly encounter with Taylor at Hollywood Forever Cemetery in the mausoleum where he's buried. I went in to take a picture of his crypt. There was nobody in the mausoleum at the time, and found the crypt. His real name is on the crypt. I think it was William Dean Tanner. And I was setting up to take the picture, and all of a sudden I got this horrible feeling of dread. And it was not only that, but I was feeling anger and I was feeling disapproval. And I literally had to get out of there. It was one of those flee or fight kind of things. Mm-hmm. And it was all I could do to keep from running. But those emotions kind of fit with the unsolved story of his death, don't they?
Oh, very much. Of course, Taylor, or Tan, or whatever you want to call him, was pretty much of a rat. He walked out on his family, just abandoned them, came to Hollywood, became a director, never sent any money back home or helped. Now, finally, his daughter went and looked him up. But he had a hobby, which was essentially taking young movie stars and debauching them and taking nude photographs of them. He's kind of an amateur photographer. And Mary Miles Minter was kind of this virginal sort of type girl, and he seduced her and took pictures of her. And of course, it's the bad thing is, as soon as you take your picture, he'd drop you and go for somebody else. He's not really a nice guy. Well, she loved him, and he dropped her. Now, we don't know who actually pulled the trigger on him. Some say it was her. Some say it was her mother. I think the mother is a better target. But the studio had to come in and pick up his collection of all these movie stars that he had taken in the buff and to cover up their image. But when it got out that she was one of his conquests, it literally destroyed her career because she couldn't be this virginal little girl anymore. She had to own up to the fact that she was a very sexually active, wild woman. And unfortunately, that's not a role the public wanted to see her play. Very beautiful woman, a very good actress, but her career was destroyed by the scandal.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think a lot of people who died in kind of ugly circumstances, like Tanner, carry that with them. They say that when you go over to the other side, you're supposed to let go of everything. Nothing is important. You know, it's a new beginning, you know. Just leave your old past behind. But I don't think that's the case always. I think there are many spirits that are angry and disapprove of the way they left this earth, and they still come and show it.
Oh, very much. In fact, I found this about Hollywood. People who go in there, especially the successful ones, tend to have huge egos. And it's like they are very reluctant to leave. And they just want to get in front of the camera just one more time. And from what we know, Taylor and Tanner, whatever we want to call him, was like that. He was just very handsome, very dynamic, and by the way, a pretty good director if you look at his films. Mm-hmm. But it would make a great deal of sense that he would haunt. Now, the house where he was shot, his little bungalow he had, is torn down. It's gone. So it could be that he would, you know, haunt an old studio or his crypt or something of that nature. Oddly enough, we haven't seen or heard or experienced any ghosts of Mary Miles Minter, but she provided the basis for my character of Helen Hester Hunter, who, as you see, has three names just like her. There's a lot of things like that that I used in the film. Yeah, the character Freddy, I kind of used Harold Lloyd as his model for that character. So I imagined him kind of looking a little like Red Buttons, the actor, when he was in a bunch of films later in life.
Now, Freddie was a very friendly character. I liked him. And I liked how it ended because, you know, on a positive note for Freddie, yay Freddie kind of thing. but it was just, it's, okay, the one thing that creeped me out about the book, which is a good thing, it's supposed to, was the way that Von Horst captured souls. Now, that reminded me of some people that I think they took a camera to somewhere deep in the jungle to some tribes that had no idea of any technology. And they felt very strongly that if their picture was taken, that the taker would have captured their soul. And you kind of have the same thing going on in the book. It's so hard not to give stuff away, so I'm trying to talk around it. But the idea that a spirit can capture your soul in any way is scary.
Well, of course. Of course, Native Americans in the Southwest and West also have that same view that if you take someone's picture, you somehow get their soul. And so that's not a new idea. In fact, when cameras were first invented, there were lots of people in Europe that felt the same way, that they didn't want their picture taken because somehow you robbed part of their personality, their soul, their humanity. You took it from them with the, I guess, the loss of privacy or the image. So I use that as kind of a plot manipulation sort of thing. I don't know if cameras can take your soul, but this was not any old camera. This was a voodoo camera. I had to put that in there and put together by some strange man in Bulgaria. So I had that as a kind of a prop for the storyline, but that was done just for the sake of the plot and the story. So if people take my picture, I do not think they have my soul.
Oh, but we could try, can't we?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Yeah, we can. But I have been in a few video productions, even a movie or two. I was an extra, pretty much. But so my soul is out there. My image has been captured and broadcast and photographed over the years.
Fortunately, not in the same way that took place in your story.
Oh, of course. Of course, Ron Hoist was only interested in women, and that he had this whole group of his slaves he had haunting his house. And, of course, he wanted our heroine to become one of them.
Yes. And you know, whether she did become that or not is up to people to read the book and find out, but mm-hmm. just the way you drew the images, I mean, you know, her going in there for the first time and the haunting starting, you know, I mean, she was very brave in the beginning, frustrated more than anything, when, and this isn't giving anything away, but when, you know, the record player played and mm-hmm. then it got unplugged and it still played, and then she broke the record and then it still played, you know. I mean, that just, I would have been out of that house in 2 minutes. You know, I'm not that I'm the biggest coward in the world, but hey, you know, if something's playing that shouldn't be playing, you know, I think I'm done.
Well, there's one part of it where she's using the computer to write the chapter for her yes. romance novel. And all of a sudden she turns and leaves it. And when she comes back, someone has written, "You will be mine." And she asked herself, well, why would I write that? Of course, she didn't. The ghost did. But I have had cases in haunted houses where the ghosts have actually typed out messages like that on a computer. And the people are working on the computer and look up, and there is some strange comment, you know, that comes from the other side. So mm-hmm. that's actually based on a factual event.
And I've heard of that happening. I heard of it. I read something about it several years ago. And it really did creep me out to the point that I was always kind of looking at my computer with a fisheye for a while. You know, waiting. It's just like, I don't want this to happen, but it's possible that it can. And they're you know, when they talk about automatic writing now, one of the new ways to do automatic writing is through the computer. So instead of holding the pencil and paper in front of you, people are closing their eyes and putting their fingers on the keyboard, and they are getting results.
I talked to a lady who wrote a whole book on the typewriter, and she said it was all done through automatic writing. Mm-hmm. She would go like, she was writing, she had a deadline, and she went to sleep. And when she woke up, there was this pile of written papers next to the typewriter, and she had been evidently typing all night long, and had done very quickly, she's a fast typist, almost uh-huh. the entire book just on a typewriter through automatic writing.
It's scary in a way, but then you and I were talking before the show a little bit about writing fiction books, and I had mentioned that when I was writing mine, there were times that I would sit down and the book kind of wrote itself. And you said, too, you let the characters kind of write the book. Do you think that is kind of a form of channeling or automatic writing?
Well, I think it is. In fact, many writers have said the same thing, including, you know, some very famous writers have have declared that the characters take on a life of their own. And I found that to be the case. You know, you make up your outline for the book, and you write a little paragraph on each character, and then as the story progresses, it never follows the outline that you originally have. Like the characters take over. You say, oh, you know, she would do that, or, you know, he would act that way. And then they would just start to evolve into something that almost takes on a life of their own.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think the genesis of that comes from when we're doing that? Who is actually helping?
The ancients, and I am a great fan of ancient history, the Greeks and Romans, believed that we have like a genius. That's what they called it, a genius, which is really a spirit. And the genius has a higher mentality than you do and kind of takes over when you just let it. And I tend to think that's kind of like what it is. We literally create characters. Now, there's also a whole group of metaphysical thought that that we can, well, our minds are so powerful, we can actually create ghosts. And maybe when you're writing a book, we're actually creating entities that can take metaphysical plane. I don't know how it works, but I just know many people have had experiences like this over the years.
Maybe it's like a thought form that we are creating the characters into a thought form, and they do, in a sense, have a life of their own. And I know there are people that are going to be shaking their heads and saying, that's crazy. But it really isn't. I mean, you have to experience it to realize that there are a lot of things going on out there that we're not familiar with, but they do happen.
Well, if you doubt it, just go sit down with your computer and try to write a book and create really real believable characters. That's where it comes. If you're using cardboard stereotypes, it's not there. But if you create a real flesh and blood kind of character with flaws or likes and dislikes, you'll notice that they seem to take on a life of their own. It's really quite fascinating. And if you do talk to other writers, you'll find that I'm not the only one, you're not the only one. Many people, even Stephen King, mentioned having experiences like that. Oh, that, you know the guy Morgan, who wrote the story about the Titan? The ship that was unsinkable and sank, mirroring exactly what happened to the Titanic 14 years after the book was published.
Yeah.
He said the same thing. He said he would almost go into a trance. And he said this book just sort of popped out. And was it a vision of the future? Was it some fictional thing? We don't know. But he was able to do that in his writings.
I think it's more common than most people think, and also that people that maybe it happens to are reticent to admit it or to bring it up for fear that people will think they're nuts. Like, you know, back 30 years ago when somebody said they saw a ghost, people would go, yeah, right, shit, you know.
Yeah, I know that story. I've been studying ghosts for a while. I heard every joke. And I've gotten every weird crank comment dealing with ghosts. But now it's more commonly accepted, and it's a little more easier to say, you know, I hunt ghosts, or I've seen them, I've had this experience. But, you know, the difference between writing fiction and writing nonfiction, nonfiction, you always have to check your notes. So it takes you a lot of time because you want to make sure everything is correct. All the names you use are spelt correctly and the dates are right. So it takes a long time to write the nonfiction stuff. I find fiction far more fun. I can just sit down and if I don't know something, I can sort of make it up as I go. But the thing that I find really funny, though, is on a lot of the facts that I just made up, I find out when I do the checking with the second or third draft that many of them are, in fact, factually correct. So they're coming out of my subconscious mind, and places and street names all mysteriously seem to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the muse coming out. Exactly. So what was, again, we're not going to give anything away, but what was your favorite part of the book to write? Where were you gleefully typing away and with a big grin on your face?
Oh, I like the seance because I know a number of gypsies and I've researched a bunch of fake psychics and stuff like that. And so I put together the heroine actually goes to a psychic to get some kind of help or advice, and she tends to be very phony. So I use all the tricks that fake psychics use. But of course, right in the middle of the fake seance she's doing, the real spirits come through, and she goes into a trance and starts giving out information. I had the most fun writing about that part of the book because it mirrored real people that I have worked with or I've known or I've unmasked over the years. By the way, read it for that alone. If you ever want to avoid being taken in by a fake psychic, that's a pretty good part right there to study.
Exactly. And, you know, I laughed out loud when she went into trance because I think you had her kind of like her head hit the table. She just went out, you know, like a light sort of thing. And it made me laugh. But, yeah, all that trickery was stuff that we hear about all the time. Well, some of us do anyway, as opposed to a seance that is a real one. And that was a very good image, the whole thing. The character herself, the psychic, was classically one that people would normally put their nose up and walk away from.
Well, I do a lot of gypsies, and were they fake? Yeah, but were they also psychic? Yeah, and sometimes they would come up with these great insights right out of the blue. They'd just pluck right out names, dates, and stuff like that without resorting to trickery. And so I did kind of base her on some real characters that I knew. Of course, I know a lot about psychics, my wife being one. And right. I've gone to numerous seances. We just finished one down at the Pasadena Playhouse down over in Pasadena, where we actually did communicate with several entities that were affiliated with the theater. So I know what the real thing is like as well.
Well, you know, you have literally spoken to many of Hollywood's late greats in seances, and I think one of the most fascinating to me was the seance that you held at the beach house in Oxnard where Rudolph Valentino came through, and you graciously allowed me to use that story in my Ghosts of Hollywood Talking to Spirits book, where Valentino told you that his untimely death at such an early age was not due to illness, but in fact, he was murdered and named his murderer. Now, that was absolutely fascinating. It wasn't surprising when he named William Randolph Hearst as the guy that did him in, nor was it surprising that Hearst had probably a good reason to do it, right?
Oh, yeah. He was very jealous of Marion Davies, and Valentino and Marion were very close. How close, we don't know. But we do know that Valentino had a lot of relationships over the years. Some people say he was gay. I tend to think he was bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
Flipped both ways. The number of women who were affiliated with Valentino in one-night stands or week-long affairs or stuff like that is pretty large. And when I researched Valentino after we had that event, I found that there are little tricks that Valentino evolved to win women over. And as I read these various biographies, I noticed they all mentioned the same little tricks that Valentino used to seduce women.
Oh.
And I almost thought about writing a book, How to Seduce Women by Rudolph Valentino, but I don't know if I'd have enough information, but it was kind of interesting. So We found this house that was rumored to be Valentino's that he used during the filming of The Sheik. And then we found the thing that did it was a bathtub. Valentino insisted on having a special kind of bathtub that he would relax in. And it was like big enough for two. And we found, and I went to the house, there it was, the black bathtub for two in the bathroom that dated back to the original equipment. So that gave me the clue that that was, in fact, the house the studio had acquired or fixed up for him.
Wow. Now, almost every celebrity-owned Hollywood house seems to have a ghost story attached to it, particularly if the stars passed away there. And you visited, as we talked about, very, very many of them. Is there one particular house that you've not had the opportunity to investigate that you would really love to get into?
Oh, there's quite a number of them I'd love to get into. Harold Lloyd's house would be up there. I'd love to get into his house, but again, I haven't had the permission. Unfortunately, Mary Pickford's old house has been torn down.
Yes.
And in fact, Valentino's house, which I've always wanted to get into, I wasn't able to actually get beyond the front door, is now torn down. And so it's kind of sad about that. But these houses all have histories on them, like the manor houses of old England. I mean, there are all kinds of different yarns and stories and ghosts and things of that nature. Sometimes the stars, sometimes the lesser people who were affiliated with the house. There's a thing I call the George Washington effect. On the East Coast, every little inn where George Washington spent one night during the Revolution has his ghost in it. And in looking into them, I have found that's not the case at all. There is like a ghost. They hear footsteps. They see apparitions. But it's probably not old George. In fact, it's sort of like, well, someone else, you know, Hans Gruber, who worked as a groom there and hung himself when his girlfriend rejected him, something like that. But who wants to stay at an inn with Hans Gruber's ghost? No. Isn't George Washington more, well, marketable or interesting? Of course. And if you hear his footsteps pacing the hallway, you can imagine he's worrying about the next battle in the Revolution and pacing the hallways instead of his poor Hans trying to decide to hang himself. But so I call that the George Washington effect. It is this, that the ghost seen in a place will always be attributed to the most famous people or person that ever lived or was linked to that site.
And I found that to be true at Gary Cooper's house. He was nowhere to be found, but there were others that were checked out from what we got. I did some research and found out they matched. They were the ones that were there, not Cooper. So, you know. It's very true. Now, we're quickly running out of time, so I think this would be a good time to let people know where they can find Fade to Fear.
Well, it can be found on Kindle, Amazon, and you can download it only, unfortunately. That's the only way it is now. But I am told if enough people download it, they will go around to printing it in some form or another. But you do download it. It's I've gotten some really fine reviews. I know Brett Steiger, the writer, has written it, read it, and wrote a very fine review for me. And if people want to read it and go back and write a review, certainly do that. It's well worth it. And I didn't make it very expensive. It's $3.95. And so anyone can afford it. And go enjoy the story and tell me what you think of it. I want to find out what I did. Now, some people actually are saying I should write a sequel. And I'm thinking I may have it set in New Orleans. And this time, instead of a mad silent movie director, it'll be a vampire.
Nice.
But but this will not be a sparkly romantic vampire. This will be a bad vampire who just thinks of people as a food source. And so I'm just kicking that idea around. And I've also actually been contacted by a guy. He may be all hot air, but he says he thinks that Fade to Fear might make a good movie.
Mm-hmm. I think it would, because in reading it, the way it's written, it's very visual. I mean, you're not just reading a book. You are seeing the images. And I always used to say this about Anne Rice's books, that as you read it, it was the movie going on in your head. You weren't just reading words. You were picturing it. And the same with this. I saw the mansion in my head. I saw the camera coming down. I saw that bedroom. The way the descriptions are, it's almost like watching a movie while you're reading it. So I think it would make a great film, honestly.
Well, thank you very much. I hope it does. Actually, it would be very great to see it. I always kind of thought while I was writing it that it would make a good screenplay. I have tried writing screenplays. I am lousy at it. I'll leave that to some other person to take on that. It's really a fine art to write a screenplay or a made-for-TV movie or anything of that nature.
Well, Fade to Fear, everybody. Get it at Amazon. I have a Mac, and Amazon has a free application that will turn your Mac into a Kindle. And that's how I read it, and it made it really, really easy. You don't need to have the Kindle to read it, and I'm sure it works the same way for PC. So it's easy to get. It's inexpensive. It's well worth the $3.99 and then some. So I hope everybody gets it, reads it, enjoys it, loves it, and writes good things about it.
Good. Yeah. Well, let me know. I'm always curious about it. Let me know if you think the character of Lynn Carlisle is one I should use again in a sequel or some other story version. She kind of, in my mind, I can see her very clearly, and mm-hmm. she could be useful in many different story scenarios.
I agree. I think you're onto something there. All right, well, before somebody comes and captures our soul, we are going to leave. So I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight, Richard. It's always a pleasure having you here, and really nice to talk about fiction for a change, because I was gleefully happy to read the book and enjoyed it immensely.
Oh, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on. It's always fun to talk with you. You're always a great host.
Aw, thanks. And I should thank everybody for tuning in tonight and listening as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.